got a sprain or an itch, pain, rash, swelling, or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. Anyone smoking around you right now? I don't mean just next to you, but in the same house. After a while, or even pretty quickly, you can often smell it. I've heard plenty of people enter a home and immediately say, oh boy, somebody's been smoking in here. Now, today's show, we're not going to talk about smoking, but about transmission of coronavirus. Carmen and I are going to try to explain that sometimes there are vague differences between air transmission and aerosol transmission. I say that because a recent article written by an expert in aerosol transmission is, to say the least, worrisome to us. She's also worried. So let's see why.
Kimberly Prather has a PhD after her name. She runs a large government-funded research center at the University of California, San Diego. And she studies aerosols.
That is, particles so tiny they float freely through the air, traveling feet or even miles, to study how viruses and other things that come out of the ocean float through the air. According to Ms. Prather, the coronavirus spreads quickly, more quickly, and for much longer periods and distances than we had thought previously. Studies have been done that show just how it spreads through restaurants, and it may be through the air conditioning systems.
Prather also studied how it attacked a church choir, even though they were spread apart while they were singing, and how it seems to spread like a wildfire on planes and on cruise ships.
A lot of evidence has been pointing to aerosol transmission of respiratory viruses. Influenza, which you know is a virus, can be passed through the air, as can the viruses that cause SARS. Prather does believe that masks can play a major role in stopping that transmission. And so does Anthony Fauci, the physician who leads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, who even referenced aerosol transmission in churches.
According to Dr. Fauci, when you sing, the amount of droplets and aerosol that comes out is really, in some respects, downright scary.
And if he's scared, maybe we should be as well. In a prospective article for the journal Science, Prather laid out the evidence for aerosol transmission and explained what people need to do to protect themselves. It spread across social media, just like coronavirus spreads across a room. Ha, I hope you enjoyed the little pun there. When a person coughs or sneezes, they generate large droplets laden with viral particles.
Here is a factoid about coughs. Coughing, which can be best described as a sudden expulsion of air from the lungs through the epiglottis at an amazingly fast speed, is estimated at 100 miles per hour.
Well, how about a sneeze? The average speed of your sneezes? Just about 90 miles per hour. And the fastest recorded sneeze was 102 miles per hour. Now, this means your liquids are expelled out of your body faster than a speeding car. Well, not all speeding cars, just the ones that go less than 100 miles an hour. Those droplets are relatively heavy and fall to the ground pretty quickly or on nearby surfaces, within seconds, actually.
They are still somewhat wet and sticky when they land. That's where the six-foot rule comes in. It is based on the studies of respiratory droplets conducted in the 1930s.
Scientists have really advanced since then, and Prather and others have developed instruments that can actually see very tiny particles, the ones we call the aerosols. Now, aerosols are measured in something called microns, or 1/1000th of a meter. A human hair measures about 100 microns in thickness. That means that you could line up about 1,500 of them in the space of 1 inch. Now, I looked up the thickness or diameter of a coronavirus, and it's just about 1/10th of a micron, meaning that 250,000 lined up would be just about an inch.
These particles, in fact, are so small that the moisture from a cough or sneeze evaporates while they are still in the air. They actually float on air current. It literally can take them hours to settle.
Aerosols can accumulate, remain infectious in indoor air for hours, and be easily inhaled deeply into the lungs. The fact that these viruses travel by airborne aerosol transmission means that 6 feet is just not far enough to stand apart. And it also means that we, well, should probably be wearing masks a lot more often. Now, this could be the reason that Taiwan has had such success stopping the spread of the infection, with only maybe a few hundred cases and only 7 deaths. Even though the country never implemented a true national lockdown. Instead, they aggressively tested their citizens, quarantined people who had tested positive for 2 weeks, and had everyone wear face masks. Everyone.
If you look at those countries that just naturally wear masks when people feel sick, those countries did a whole lot better than those that did not.
These researchers concluded that maybe you should be wearing a mask both indoors and outdoors, like we just said, especially if you're walking outdoors in a place where you can see other people, even if they are farther away than just 6 feet. So you might now be wondering whether the cloth masks have any utility. And recent studies have shown that homemade cloth masks can be as effective at blocking the virus as many surgical masks.
The trick here is that they have to fit to your face. If you look at all these people who are wearing bandanas, they are just hanging down. That's not good because aerosol will just float right around.
Remember, aerosols are really light, so if you can feel a breeze, they'll be in that breeze. That's one reason why face shields, you know, those plastic coverings that people are wearing over their faces, they don't work without a mask. Face shields may block droplets, but aerosols, well, they can still find a way in. Think of welders with full face masks who can still get burns on their face, even on areas that are apparently covered by the masks.
But do not think that this all means that the masks are useless, even if your mask isn't perfect or perfectly worn. It may still do you a world of good.
This is because the dose of the virus you're exposed to determines how sick you'll get. So even if you only cut it back by 70%, the severity of the disease may be much less.
We really have to start looking at the future. The entire nation has to use this as a real learning experience. The trauma is not just with those directly affected by the disease.
Nursing homes are ground zero for the COVID pandemic and require policies to immediately isolate residents with symptoms and reduce visitors. We must prepare so that hospitals don't become overwhelmed should coronavirus reappear or even another entirely different pandemic rear its ugly head. Caring for people with chronic conditions will involve telemedicine. And believe me, we work with many of the elderly who live in nursing homes, and most of these facilities are simply unprepared even as late as today in this pandemic. Many are still unfamiliar with and unprepared to use telemedicine.
Patients and families worldwide are left to wonder what the path forward will be to mitigate the profound psychological fallout from visitor restrictions imposed by hospitals, nursing homes, and care facilities.
Not only are patients with COVID-19 isolated and treated as social pariahs, but families are helpless in their effort to touch and comfort a loved one in a time of really exquisite need. But those in nursing homes are not the only ones that can suffer. Even patients hospitalized for problems not related to COVID-19 are affected.
Their trauma is just as distressing as they live a digital nightmare with their families via blurry video chatting about risky surgeries and end-of-life care.
The despair felt by forced separation of patients and families during this time is simply overwhelming. A meta-analysis shows loneliness as a key driver for all causes of mortality. It underscores the critical need for in-person social support for patients. pharmacies are also running out of antidepressant medicine and are having a hard time filling the prescriptions that are coming in right now.
Since the present video chatting services are inadequate at alleviating the consequences of physical isolation, new and better ones need to be created for future health dilemmas, such as future pandemics.
Families' descriptions of the intense trauma that they experience because of these restrictions could also worry society about the unintended consequences of such draconian policies, including a widespread increase in post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, in both patients and families. The consequences of all this are real and they are tangible. In women, PTSD is associated with significantly higher total health care costs, even after controlling for depression, chronic medical illness, and demographic differences.
Failure to address this visitation quandary will almost certainly mean a significant increase in PTSD and other psychological sequelae, and the impact of coronavirus will probably last years, if not decades.
So what's the solution? A measured policy based on compassion and scientific merit should be foundational and guide decision-making on visitation privileges. The devastating lack of personal protective equipment has made the prospect even more difficult. Understandably, hospital systems can't afford to distribute this equipment liberally to all family members, as it is essential to protect the health of the frontline workers at this time.
Because of this, any policy that eases visitors' restrictions will undoubtedly invite risk to patients and family members. But it is not impossible to imagine a scenario where the benefits outweigh the risks of reuniting family members, if it's done carefully and methodically.
And this is just another reason why we have to prepare now for future problems, again, with a possible resurgence of coronavirus or any new pandemic. But let's get back to face masks for a moment. We've talked about cloth face masks and surgical face masks. There are also the N95 masks, if you've heard of them. Since these are in short supply, most are being used by healthcare professionals who work directly with patients who are being treated for the infection. We talked for a bit about the size of the virus. Now let's talk about the size of the openings in these masks and see if they're preventing the virus from passing through.
None of the masks even come close to preventing a virus from penetrating the mask from one side or another.
For lack of a better word, the holes in the mask are bigger than the virus itself. But this is just one factor in the success of masks.
Even in the cloth bandana masks, about 20% of the virus is stopped. It is much better in the surgical masks, and of course, even better, up to 95% successful in the N95 masks.
Apparently, there is more, maybe a lot more, to just size of orifices in the masks that prevent them from allowing the virus through. And remember, as we said in the first part of the show, the less virus inhaled or in contact with you, the less chance you'll have of getting a more severe infection.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years.
We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. Do you remember the brouhaha concerning President Trump's use of hydroxychloroquine to prevent getting COVID-19, as well as the more recent article in the prestigious medical journal?
The Lancet, which stated that a study was done that showed that administering the drug to patients hospitalized with COVID-19 actually worsened their symptoms.
Well, the Lancet has formally retracted that study that associated hydroxychloroquine with decreased survival and increased risk of heart arrhythmias in patients. That previous report had actually led the World Health Organization, WHO, to suspend clinical trials, and government officials in several countries stopped using it as a treatment method.
Just a few days ago, three of the authors of the paper retracted their study and have concluded that they can no longer vouch for the veracity of the primary data sources.
The ups and downs of research are ever present, and we should expect problems like this to appear whenever there is a pressing need to get research done quickly. Many of our own U.S. citizens are questioning whether all the policies that were employed here were really of any use. They often cite Sweden, a country which maintained a more relaxed attitude toward the pandemic.
But the fact is that Sweden has seen a higher death rate than its neighbors. Sweden's per capita death rate was 36 per 100,000, which is higher than the United States, and 27 and neighboring Denmark at 9.
And as I said, for Americans anxious for the end of government-mandated coronavirus lockdowns, and for those opposed to these restrictions in the first place, Sweden has become a rallying cry.
In March, while many countries were closing businesses and schools and asking citizens to stay home, Sweden largely remained open, including restaurants, shops, and gyms.
Now, Swedes do practice physical distancing, but officials rely on people to voluntarily follow these guidelines. People over age 70 who are at higher risk from COVID-19 are also strongly advised to limit physical contact and just stay home. And over a previous week, Sweden has also had, unfortunately, the highest per capita death rate for COVID-19 in Europe. Even with Sweden's lack of a lockdown, the country is still a long way from herd immunity. Now, remember, we spoke about that last week. Herd immunity relates to the point at which enough people are immune to a virus that it stops spreading out of control.
The pandemic has also exposed some of the country's health inequalities. Immigrant communities in Sweden were among those hardest hit by the virus.
Sweden's chief epidemiologist, Anders Tegnell, said that the country's approach to physical distancing, in his words, worked well. But then he added that long-term care homes for adults, for the older adults in particular, weren't protected as well as they should have been.
During the past several months, with so many people out of work and confined to their homes, many have been able to get more sleep, while others, worried about their future, are actually getting even less sleep than usual.
So the first thing that we should learn is to get into a good night's sleep routine. Right off the bat, we need to figure out how much sleep we really need. Then we can determine what is the ideal. When is the ideal time to go to bed, and when should we wake up for, let us call it, optimal health?
Many experts believe that sleep is just as important to a person's health as food and water. Getting the right amount of sleep can help prevent disease, boost immunity, and improve mental health.
Still, many of us are just not getting enough sleep. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, estimates that about one-third of adults consistently do not get the sleep that they need. The benefits of proper sleep are well worth the effort that it takes. A person's age, we know this, can affect the amount of sleep that we need. This is not a fixed amount, since some people need more sleep than others, but a general guideline. Factors include lifestyle, health conditions, and, you probably guessed, a genetic makeup.
You can find a nice table on the National Sleep Foundation's website that shows what amount of sleep is recommended for people of different ages.
Now, according to that table, school-aged children of 6 to 13 years generally need 9 to 11 hours, while teenagers, well, they need 8 to 10 hours, and adults 26 to 24 need 7 to 9. Now, us older adults, probably just 7 to 8 hours. The NSF reports that, on average, people take 10 to 20 minutes to fall asleep. So if you generally need more than that, you're going to have to get to adjust the time that you go to bed accordingly.
So, if you wish to awaken at 6 a.m., then you should probably go to bed around 9:45 in the evening. This gives you about 15 minutes to get to sleep, leaving you with 8 hours of actual sleep.
You may have heard of REM sleep, that's R-E-M sleep, and the letters mean rapid eye movement. And to be properly rested, the body must go through several sleep cycles per night, including rapid eye movement sleep and non-rapid eye movement sleep. To give you an idea of the stages, Carmen and I are going to give you a brief resume of these three stages. Actually, it's four. First is, of course, stage one, which is a non-REM sleep, which lasts about 15 minutes. Here, the breathing, heart rate, and brain waves begin to slow. After this is another stage of non-REM, which occurs before the body actually enters deep sleep. The muscles relax even more than they were, and the body temperature drops.
Stage three. A non-REM sleep is next, and this is where a person's breathing and heart rate are at the lowest levels. Your body needs to reach this stage of deep sleep to feel rested, and it lasts longer in the first half of the night.
And finally, we get to REM sleep. Within 90 minutes of falling asleep, a person enters REM sleep. Now, the brain actually becomes more active. It's here that most dreaming occurs, and the arms and legs become temporarily paralyzed. If the body does not go through these stages several times a night, the person may wake feeling fatigued and unfocused. If you're trying to lose weight, then you should know that recent research suggests that a lack of sleep could make a person more likely to gain weight.
One study showed that nurses who slept 5 hours or fewer were more likely to have obesity than those who slept 7 hours on average.
A possible reason for the association is that being tired may change the brain in a way that leads to excessive eating. Now, meanwhile, one study found that lack of sleep was linked to more emotional eating and trouble managing weight. Results of another, they indicated that getting only 4.5 hours of sleep increased hunger and appetite in the study participants. Those who got 8.5 hours of sleep did not have this issue.
Overall, it is likely a good idea for anyone looking to lose weight to aim for 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night. Getting enough sleep may help prevent certain health conditions.
The National Heart and Lung and Blood Institute said that sleep deprivation can increase the risk of heart disease, diabetes, kidney disease, and even depression. Lack of sleep may also increase a person's risk of injury. All that we have talked about so far is a lack of sleep. Like drinking too little water and too much water can affect your health, sleeping too much can also harm you.
One study found that while getting too little sleep increased the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, getting more than 8 hours a night elevated this risk even more.
So the question remains, how can we improve not only the quantity of sleep, but the quality of sleep in order to get our best health? One way is to improve the sleep that you do get is to be consistent. Going to bed and waking up at the same time every day helps the body develop a rhythm, which may make it easier to fall asleep and wake up feeling rested. You should also get daily exercise, as this can also improve sleep quality. It has definitely been shown to help those who have chronic insomnia.
You have also probably heard that you should avoid caffeine and nicotine. Both are considered stimulants and can take several hours or longer to leave the bloodstream, potentially interfering with sleep.
You might wish to drown out sound and light using earplugs, a white noise machine, and room darkening curtains or window treatments can help. Don't know where to get a white noise machine? Look no further than your smartphone. There are many applications, some are free, that provide white noise, such as wind blowing, water falling, gently, along with many other varieties of repetitive sounds. Some even like to hear repetitive mantras to get them more restful sleep, and you can also find apps on your phone as well for these. And remember, the blue light on many of these devices can suppress melatonin, which is a hormone that's necessary for sleep. So you might want to turn those items off or just cover the blue light if possible.
But if you cannot get to sleep, even with all this advice, then you might need to talk with your physician and see what other treatments can be suggested. In many cases, lifestyle adjustments can improve sleep quality and quantity. Prepare a nice meal. Think about having a massage or getting into a jacuzzi.
However, if these changes are not effective, you got to see a doctor. Underlying health conditions, certain medications, and other factors can interfere with quality sleep. If a person frequently has trouble sleeping, again, you may need to see a doctor about a sleep study. And this can help identify many other sleep disorders. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.